So after yesterday's class, then Janani Das Prabhu had a question I thought might be relevant. That if I remember properly, it was he saw that I was speaking a lot on doing the duty and all this and about, and just wondering why so much emphasis on that. Basically, it comes from a few different things. We see Krishna is always talking about that. That is the nature of the mode of goodness, is one is doing it not because of attachment. It means we're talking about the, yeah, not because of attachment. It means spiritual attachment is fine. But what we're talking about is the conditioned living entity hasn't come to the platform of spiritual attachment. So because of this, we deal with the material nature. And because of that, we are not able to overcome. So we have attachment for material nature. So the mode of goodness is do the duties within the material nature, but not because of attachment. Because we're supposed to do them. That's our proper duty. We do them. That's the rule. We follow it. Then things work very, very nicely. So Krishna is then trying to put that forward. This is an important aspect. We'll see this comes up when we start discussing on the various chapters. So we must remember that devotional service, now here when we're getting technical, see, if we're not being technical, we say devotional service, and that means anything in connection with Krishna. Any kind of activity that we're trying to please Krishna, no matter what our level is, that's devotional service. Now here we're becoming a little technical, especially Bhurijan Prabhu is bringing out these more technical points, where you have sakam, karma bhakti means sakam, means one's own needs one is attending to. That becomes very prominent. And then after taking care of one's needs, then one connects those things to Krishna. Right? One does your activity, your karma, then you get a result from that, which is yours, and then you give some of that to Krishna. Right? That'll be sakam. Nishkam means you perform the activity, it's Krishna's work. The results that come are Krishna's. Even though it may be with you, you may be the one that's taking care of it. You're running a business. And, you know, as far as all legal things go, it's your business. But you consider in your heart it's Krishna's, and the results are Krishna's, and it's for using in Krishna's service. So basically the difference between sakam and nishkam is a matter of consciousness. Then we see that so in both there's a practice that you're trying to come up to a advanced platform. You're trying to come up to an elevated platform by giving up material attachments. So Krishna is always pushing this, do your duties because you're supposed to, not because you just want to. You do it because you want to, that's sakam. That means there's some passion, some ignorance involved. But you do it because it's supposed to be done, like that, and you want to please Krishna. So then, that is nishkam. Means nishkam, means no desire, without desire, means without any material motive. And sakam means with material motive, though you're going to engage the result in Krishna's service. So, then we have the sadhana bhakti, which is then above these two, but that means that one is simply engaged in hearing and chanting, you know, remembering the Lord. This is the sadhana. So generally the conditioned soul needs a little bit more than that, unless they're already advanced. Previous lifetimes they've already done so much. Like you see somebody coming back again. Maybe they were already a strong preacher. Then they come back again. They didn't finish their service. So they may be able to work just on this platform of sadhana. But we must remember that here, when we get technical, bhakti means starts from the platform of Brahma-bhuta. Like you'll see, Krishna's talking about the sage with equal vision. Then he's talking about the Brahma-bhuta platform. In other words, when we get to the uttam platform, That is called bhakti, when we get very technical. Then below that is sadhana bhakti. Right? Below that is sadhana bhakti. Even at the stage of bhava, then that is technically called bhava. It's not actually even necessarily called fully. It is bhakti. But it's still different from prema. Because one is still developing, one can fall from such a position. One is still situating oneself. But the platform of prema, then one is very well situated. So basically we're talking about devotional service, meaning with affection and that for Krishna. Because bhava is also called rati, which means affection, attachment to Krishna. So that is where devotional service is seriously starting. Advanced devotional service starts from madhyam, but it's still within the realm of sadhana. So that a Krishna is given is the second option. First option is just from the word go, you come to the platform of an Uttamadhikari. You know, it's been done before. We see the gopis have done that. The wives of the Yagi Brahmins did that. Kulashekar, not Kulashekar. You know that one king? Huh? One king, he was fighting for the demigods, and then they told him he had one moment to live, and he surrendered in that moment. Katvanga, yes, Maharaj Katvanga. So it's possible. And it's definitely the easiest, most direct method. Right? But if we find a difficulty with that, it means we made our determination to surrender in the moment and it didn't happen. You know, we woke up in the morning, we were still the same conditioned person, you know, still the same material body, no spiritual body. Then we can consider then the sadhana is going to be our next option. And that means surrendering to the spiritual master. Because serious sadhana bhakti means we're actually coming in the line of sampradaya. Anyone who accepts the supremacy of Vishnu is a devotee. That's why it's considered an offense. Also one of the 10 offenses to the Holy Dham is that one thinks badly or speaks badly about the either the residents or the pilgrims to the Dham. Because they're all devotees. They all come, they've come to see Krishna. They may be sampradaya, they may not be. But they're devotees. But now, better than just ordinary devotee, because it's more a quicker process, is surrender to the spiritual master. This is where serious then sadhana bhakti starts. And this is also part of bhakti. So there we'll see, Krishna's saying you take up bhakti. You know, just doing your duty without, you can have a life member who does his duty. He runs his business, takes care of his house without any attachment. So that's good, that's nishkam karma. But it's not as connected as someone who then surrenders to the spiritual master and follows the regulative principles for developing, for advancing. So you have these different levels. So in this, then sometimes we'll notice that. We're only talking about devotional service. In our discussion here, in Krishna's discussion, we're only talking devotional service. He shows some side paths, you know, your Ashtanga yoga and these different things. But Krishna is actually only recommending the process of devotional service, which means doing your activity for pleasing Krishna. But since, especially, you know, the modern culture, both East and West, but especially in the West, there's not a great emphasis put on duty. Duty is, you know, it's nice. It's good. You know, everybody respects it. But it's not expected that you'll do that. Generally, they think, what would be the normal emotional reaction to any situation is the normal thing for someone to do. Then if they can be dutiful, then that's a plus. But it's kind of like you accept people kind of on the normal emotional exchange, except for some basic principles. You want to have a job, you got to do what the boss says. But it's more of the, you know, the animal and the stick. Means you don't follow what the boss says. You get fired. So it's national. If you're smart, you just do it. But we're talking about in the social exchange that no one's going to get, people may be disappointed, but nothing's going to happen to you or necessarily your money or other kinds of things, your facilities, if you're not necessarily nice to people you meet or deal with your family nicely or friends or relatives, like that. So that's what we're talking. So the whole idea is that Arjuna is an Aryan, right? And Krishna points that out, that you're speaking like someone who's not an Aryan, because you're talking about giving up your duty. You're talking about not doing your job as a Kshatriya and then going out begging or this or that. And he says an Aryan wouldn't talk like that. So an Aryan means one who accepts the Vedic culture. And that one who can't work in the Vedic culture is a non-Aryan. It doesn't mean they don't respect it, they don't interface, but they generally live outside the mainstream. You know, they live in the forest or other places. They would not be mainstream. They would not be taken as role models by the. Their alternative, their alternative view of life would not be appreciated by the mainstream culture because it doesn't necessarily lead one to a higher platform like that. Is that kind of clear? Like that. Because when we deal technically, then when we say do one's duty for Krishna without attachment, without desire for results, we're talking about nishkam karma, which means performing your activities, prescribed duties, you know, in a devotional mood, as your devotional service. But there's duties that go along with that. If you're managing, then there's duties that go along with that. You have to take care of those underneath you. You have to deal in a certain way. If you're following some leadership, that you have duties, how you deal, how you interact. And if we don't do that, then there's no culture. Culture doesn't function. Thank you. Culture doesn't function. So we may say whatever we like, we're just being straightforward, but that doesn't mean that it's on the Aryan platform. You know? An Aryan platform is where human life starts. So it may be a system, right? I mean, there's 8,400,000. 400,000 are human. Of that, only a few are civilized. Civilized means follows Vedic culture. So a bulk of the 400,000 are uncivilized. So there is a lot of social options on how we interface with each other. But we will find that they don't necessarily give great happiness. You know? Like, I mean, dogs don't mind each other, but, I mean, you look at the life of a dog, no one's really thinking that this is a great life, you know, growling and barking at each other and stuff like that. So we have to be... Yeah, we have to accept. So many times I'll emphasize this, maybe even overemphasize it, just for the point is that we have a tendency in this age to want to avoid duty, because duty means restriction, and in this age restriction is not considered a good word. You know, it's like we don't... Others should be restricted, of course, like that, so they don't get in my way. But restricting myself, that's a problem. It's called cramping your style, right? Someone shouldn't get in your way. Everybody else should understand you. You're an individual, you know, and that. And you have your ways, and they must understand your upbringing or the situation made me act like this or like that. Everybody else should be very broad-minded, liberal, tolerant, patient, peaceful, everything like this. But you yourself, you can just be washed by the emotions and do whatever you like. Everybody else must be highly trained and qualified and all that. Then this is a good community. I can adjust with this. I'm inspired by this. You know, why didn't people inspire me? Why did they get on my case? Why didn't they inspire me and bring out the good and recognize the good? At the same time as when I got a little free time, I'm sitting with my friends, I'm just bad-mouthing and chopping the whole universe to shreds. Like that. So we have to be very careful of this. So the Aryan culture means we ourselves know what we're supposed to do, and we also know how we're supposed to relate with others. So we don't expect necessarily others are going to relate. Because we know if someone acts improperly, we know how to act with someone who doesn't act properly. But we can't not act properly and expect everybody else is going to be the Aryans. Right? An Aryan knows how to deal with an uncultured person. Right? But we shouldn't go around and in the cultured society act like someone uncultured and expect everybody else is going to be cultured. No, we just came in off the street. We're uncultured, so we can expect everybody else has just come off the street. They may also may not be cultured, so they may not tolerate. So just as when one dog barks, the other one barks back. You know? Okay, a dog barks, an elephant walks by, couldn't care less. But we must remember, we've all come from the street. So if we bark, we can expect everybody else is going to bark also. So we have to be able to accept, you know, how we deal. Okay, so then for today's point, then Bhurijan Prabhu in his study of the Gita saw that Srila Prabhupada divides the Gita into three parts. The first six chapters, the second six chapters, and the last six chapters. And then Prabhupada makes some comments on that. So this is division one, chapters 1-6. This is from 7.1. In the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, the living entity has been described as non-material spirit soul, capable of elevating himself to self-realization by different types of yogas. Then next quote from 13.2. In the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, the knower of the body, the living entity, and the position by which he can understand the Supreme Lord are described. And from 18.1. In the first six chapters, stress was given to devotional service, yoginam api sarvesham. Of all yogis or transcendentalists, one who always thinks of me within himself is the best. So, the emphasis here is on understanding the difference between matter and spirit. This is knowledge. The difference between matter and spirit, and who is the controller of both. This is real knowledge. So the first thing, if we want to get somewhere in spiritual life, we have to understand that we are not the body. And when that's understood, and then we can differentiate between matter and spirit, then we can actually get somewhere. So this is being pointed out in the first six chapters. This is very much brought home. This is called sambandha. So we see the sambandha is very much the what is being described here. At the same time, as Prabhupada points out, that the different kinds of yoga are being described. And Prabhupada mentions that is these are the different ways, different and the position which he can understand the Supreme Lord. So now you've distinguished between matter and spirit. So that means we can see ourselves, see the Supreme Lord, and see the material nature. So now the process is how we can get to Krishna. These are described in the first six chapters. And then in the last quote here, then each time Krishna mentions these various paths that one can take, Krishna always brings it to this point. The best of all yogis is one who is surrendered to him, one who is a devotee. So Krishna has pointed out the living entity is separate from the material nature, and you have a process by which you can come to the spiritual platform. And the best of all those platforms is the devotional platform. So this is what's being discussed in the first six chapters. Then in division 2, chapters 7-12, then this is from 18.1. In the next six chapters, pure devotional service and its nature and activities were discussed. And 13.1-2. In the middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the relationship between the individual soul and the super soul in regard to devotional service are described. The superior position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the subordinate position of the individual soul are defined in these chapters. The living entities are subordinate under all circumstances. but in their forgetfulness they are suffering. When enlightened by pious activities, they approach the Supreme Lord in different capacities. As the distressed is those in want of money, the inquisitive and those in search of knowledge. That is also described. Then, from 8:28, the words idam viditva indicate that one should try to understand the instructions given by Sri Krishna in this chapter and the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita. One should try to understand these chapters not by scholarship or mental speculation, but by hearing them in association with devotees. Chapters 6 through 12 are the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. The first six and the last six chapters are like coverings for the middle six chapters, which are especially protected by the Lord. If one is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita, especially these middle six chapters, in the association of devotees, then his life at once becomes glorified beyond all penances. Beyond all penances, sacrifices, charities, speculations, etc. For one can achieve all the results of these activities simply by Krishna consciousness. Then from 10:1, previously beginning with the seventh chapter, the Lord has already explained his different energies and how they are acting. Now in this chapter, he explains his specific opulences to Arjuna. In the previous chapter, he has clearly explained his different energies to establish devotion in firm conviction. Again, in this chapter, he tells Arjuna about his manifestations and various opulences. So here now, before, it's been described very clearly that there is a living entity, there's God, there's a process to get there. So now here, very clearly, he points out this relationship in the matter of devotional service. That devotional service is that connection. Because otherwise, what happens is, the living entity, because of his prakriti nature, his materialistic conditioned nature, the externals become very, very important for them. Very important. So here Krishna is pointing out that in the first six chapters he's going through the externals that you see. And even Arjuna asks that. Okay, now you've said that there is a spiritual nature, there is the person who engages in the spiritual nature. Now, tell me about them. How do they walk? How do they, you know, how do they sit? How do they talk? How do they deal? I can see that. You know, you tell me what's going on inside, I can't. So, Krishna explains the external things that are going on. You have your duty, your work, you do that. You know, but for Krishna. So the emphasis is on this aspect. Then, here in this chapters, in the middle six, then he points out that this relationship is devotion. That is the actual platform. We're not trying to do our duties perfectly just because we want to be perfect in our duties. No, we're trying to do our duties perfectly to please Krishna. We're trying to do our charities, our sacrifices, everything to please Krishna. So devotion is actually the essence of everything. That's actually what's going on. So even though you're doing, Krishna's recommended this niskam karma, and he spent two chapters explaining it. But it's still to be done in the mood of devotion. Because with time, we will come from the Kanista platform where we have to act, we have to take our activities and engage them in Krishna. We can't stop activities. We only know material nature. We don't have an alternative. Right? So, and generally you'll find one cannot just function simply on the platform of the intelligence and just take up jnana. Because jnana has no activities. Therefore, unless one already has realization, you're not going to get realization by jnana. Jnana does not lead to vijnana without activities. Right? When you have an activity that is done in detachment, that gives realization. So therefore, Krishna points out that this position of nishkam karma is superior even than to jnana yoga. Though on the material platform, you put jnana yoga as higher than karma yoga. Because the intelligence is more fine than the mind and senses. And it's everyone's looking for a position in the material world. Everyone wants to be superior to someone else. Therefore, it's all set up like that. Someone always has somebody above them and someone below them. But you know, as you move up, you feel good. Even though you still got an unlimited amount of people above you. But you kind of tend to gloss that over. You just kind of, you know, look at how many notches you've come up and all that. So you have to give karma. Otherwise, what are people going to do? If they don't have an authorized way to go for their distinction, adoration, and profit, they'll go for it in a sinful way, and that sinful way will disturb everybody else. So better they're pious. So Krishna points out, now we're accustomed to this. So rather than be sinful, we be pious. And then by this, we can surrender very nicely. And we do that for Krishna. But as we go, as one comes to the Mandyam platform, then the duty, doing a prescribed duty, isn't so much the important element. It means that you have the nature of a particular, varna ashram, that becomes the essential element for you. No, the devotion becomes much more prominent because the heart is more pure. But still one follows it, because Krishna says that anyone becomes purified by that. Even advanced people become purified by penance, charity, and austerity. No, penance, charity, and sacrifice. So one does it, and it's an example for others. But here in these chapters, he's pointing out that devotion is the actual essential point. He wants to make sure we don't miss the point. When we're talking about nishkam karma, he doesn't want us to miss the point that is the essential point. That is our stepping stone to get to pure bhakti. And Krishna accepts it as bhakti. If the emphasis is on pleasing Krishna. So he's putting out that point here, like that. So now we can understand this not by scholarship or mental speculation, because the jnana doesn't give the realization. You get it by association of devotees. So this means association means we're going to take up sadhu sangha, then bhajana kriya. Bhajana kriya, nartana vritti, like this we'll progress. So Krishna's recommending that we follow according to sampradaya. We follow in the proper fashion. So this means the sadhana bhakti then becomes an essential part of it. Right? The nishkan karma includes sadhana, or is an anga of sadhana, which is an anga of pure devotional service. So that connection is there. Otherwise we just do nishkan karma, it's nice, it's pious. Right? That is the next point. Is The next point is that... means someone who's pious, who takes up following the Lord's prescribed duties for the purpose of duty and to please the Lord, then they are on this platform of those who surrender to Krishna. It means those who become devotees, who are inquisitive, or who have interest in economic development, or interest in just removing anxieties, or those who actually want to please the Lord by knowing the Lord. Right? So Krishna is recommending that one doesn't stay on this platform where we are wanting something material from our devotional service. But we are coming to devotional service because we want to please Krishna for the devotional aspect. Right? So this is being made. But that is done when one comes to this platform of piety. So performing prescribed duties is pious. And then doing that in the mode of goodness is more recommended. But more than that is doing that, but by in the association of devotees, surrendering to the devotees. So that then takes on the strong nature of devotional service. It doesn't carry the flavor of just Vedic culture, but the actual transcendental, the Daiva Varnashram. Okay, and then the last point is that the Krishna's already explained his opulences, because he's now starting to talk about himself, but now he gets more specific detail just to bring out more faith. Because the whole point is ultimately we're not looking at a process. A process has some place it's going, and there's some reason you follow a process. You don't just do something just for nothing. If you have a specific process, you do it because there is a goal. So the goal is Krishna, and he's a person. So we're trying to come to that platform realizing he's a person. So Krishna is explaining more about himself. We see all these things are happening in the 7th through 11th chapters. He's describing himself, who he is, and then how we can understand how to relate to him. Like that. Then Arjuna then gives his conclusion after seeing all this that he is the Supreme Person. Makes it very, very clear. Then Division 3, chapters 13 through 18. Now starting with the 13th chapter, how the living entity comes into contact with material nature, and how he is delivered by the Supreme Lord through the different methods of fruitive activities, cultivation of knowledge, and the discharge of devotional service are explained. Although the living entity is completely different from the material body, he somehow or another becomes related. This is also explained. This is 13:1-2. And then from 18:1. In the third six chapters, knowledge, renunciation, the activities of material nature and transcendental nature, and devotional service were being described. It was concluded that all acts should be performed in conjunction with the Supreme Lord, represented by the words Om Tat Sat, which indicate Vishnu, the Supreme Person. The third part of Bhagavad Gita has shown that devotional service and nothing else is the ultimate purpose of life. This has been established by citing past acharyas and the Brahma Sutra, the Vedanta Sutra. Certain impersonalists consider themselves to have a monopoly on the knowledge of Vedanta Sutra, but actually the Vedanta Sutra is meant for understanding devotional service. For the Lord himself is the compiler of the Vedanta Sutra, and he is its knower. That is described in the 15th chapter. In every scripture, every Veda, devotional service is the objective. That is explained in Bhagavad Gita. So, in the first six chapters, then we see the emphasis is on the performing the prescribed duties, engaging your activities in the Lord's service. Now, in these last six, the technicalities of what's going on there, how the living entity became conditioned, is that's natural that you want to know. But not the thing of, well, how did we get in here? We want to know what happens when you get in there. Right? It's just like if you... Yeah. So we need to know just how much it takes to know how to get out. The essential elements of how we came in that help us get out, those things are explained. Those things can be told. So this kind of the more intellectual understanding of what is going on here. What is renunciation? Because otherwise someone thinks renunciation is just giving up all material things. The real renunciation is engaging Krishna's service, because it's not ours to give up anyway. You know, I find 100 rupees on the street, and then I pick it up and I go, I renounce this. It wasn't ours. You know, or the bank teller is there counting all the money, so many lakhs, and at the end of the day he says, I renounce all this, and then puts it in the safe. It's that he doesn't have the choice to not renounce it. It wasn't his in the first place. So the actual knowledge means what is in relationship to Krishna. Actual renunciation means how to engage things in the Lord's service. The activities of the material nature, how the material nature itself works, and then how we can work within the material nature without becoming entangled. So all these things are described. Oh, and then the material, how to tell the difference between material and spiritual, and how engaging in the Lord's service is devotional service. So these are described. So the technical aspects that are presented in the first six chapters are then given in the last six chapters. And both of these are in support of the middle six chapters, which are telling us to take up devotional service. So that's, do we see these, how these three divisions work? Is that clear? Any questions on this? It's just a little subtle, but at the same time not so. First six chapters are dealing with separating, putting the idea that we're not the body, we're the soul. So therefore bodily considerations for performing activities is rejected, and spiritual reasons for performing our same activities are being pushed forward. And in doing these activities, those activities that bring you to the platform of devotion to God are the best. The last six then explain technically how that's all working. How the material nature, how the living entity, all the interaction and all the field of activities and the modes of nature and all these different things are described, because that's what we're going to run into, you know, in performing our activities. We want to switch from being under the modes and being attached to the body and thinking we're the body to understanding we're the spirit soul and not acting under the modes. So we have to be able to distinguish that. So that knowledge is given in the last six chapters. But why we're doing all that, to develop our love for Krishna and interface with Krishna as a person, we are persons, he's a person, that is given in the middle six chapters. Right? Does that make some sense? Because when you learn something, then first thing you learn is what it is, the elements. Then you learn how to use it, apply it. Then, once you understand that, then you can be taught what are the purposes behind it and all the fine technicalities and all those things. Therefore, in the first, then Krishna just gives these are the systems. You're not the body or the soul, and these are the systems for understanding that, getting out of here. And then the last six, he gives the different technicalities behind it, how that's working. Because once you understand the first, and then you understand that doing this for devotion, then the technicalities mean something. Otherwise, the technicalities without understanding devotion, it's just another flowery language of the Vedas. Right? Flowery language, you'll enjoy yourself going to heavenly planets, doing so much ritual, or you'll enjoy in the Brahman. So both are flowery language. Both of them have no substance. Okay. So any questions on that? Okay, now in the next appendix, Bhurijan Prabhu gives us a summary of the whole Bhagavad Gita, and where he just describes what is going on, just in a, you know, straight through, like that, in an essay form. So we'll read that. That gives a nice understanding. And next we will go into the actual chapter by chapter. A summary of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita opens with the blind king Dhritarashtra requesting his secretary Sanjay to narrate the battle between his sons, the Kauravas, and their cousins, the Pandavas. Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, out of affection for his devotee, the Pandava prince Arjuna, has agreed to drive his chariot. As Arjuna takes up his bow and prepares to fight, he sees the sons of Dhritarashtra drawn in military array and requests infallible Krishna to draw his chariot between the two fighting forces. There, in the midst of both armies, Arjuna's mind reels as he foresees the imminent death of his teacher, relatives, friends, and friends. He throws down his bow and arrows and decides not to fight. In chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2, Arjuna presents his arguments for refusing to fight. Basically, he fears the sinful reactions of killing. But after Arjuna surrenders to Lord Krishna and requests the Lord to instruct him, the Lord begins countering Arjuna's objections. First, Krishna analytically explains that no killing can actually take place because the eternal soul never dies. Krishna then explains that fighting in his service is transcendental and will bring no sinful reaction. Krishna also explains the Veda's purpose as being the gradual elevation of souls to Krishna consciousness. Krishna thus encourages Arjuna to remain fixed in his service, fight, and ignore the mind's distress, desires. As Krishna explains why Arjuna should fight, As Krishna's explanations why Arjuna should fight were only a summary, and since Krishna glorifies both Buddhi Yoga, intelligence used in spiritual advancement of knowledge, that's Bhagavad Gita, that's from chapter 245 and 249-50, and karma work, as chapter 247-48 and 50, Arjuna becomes confused and wishes to use Krishna's instructions to perform Buddhi Yoga as an excuse to retire from the battlefield for a life of contemplation. Arjuna therefore opens chapter 3 asking Krishna why he is encouraging fighting if intelligence is better than fruit of work. Krishna then explains Karma Yoga, reaction-free devotional work, and clears up Arjuna's mistaken idea that all work is fruitive and leads to bondage.
Krishna explains that Arjuna should fight, for avoiding sinful reactions through devotional work is better than attempting to escape reactions through renouncing work. Krishna also instructs Arjuna to fight to set the proper example of duty. Krishna therefore tells Arjuna to fight, but with knowledge and detachment, 3:29-30, without falling victim to his own attractions and aversions. Then in answer to Arjuna's question on the cause of a soul's being impelled to improper action or neglect of duty, Krishna names the enemy, lust. He recommends Arjuna regulate his senses, become fixed in his pure identity as a servant of Krishna, and thereby avoid lust's control. With spiritual strength and deliberate intelligence, he should conquer that forceful and sinful enemy, lust. Since in chapter 3, Krishna has recommended that Arjuna fight in full knowledge of him, 3:30. The Lord, in chapter 4, explains different aspects of transcendental knowledge. First, Krishna explains attaining knowledge through the disciplic succession. Then, after successively explaining his own appearance and mission, the Lord explains his devotional service as the goal of all sacrifices. Krishna has already referred to the importance of performing yajna sacrifice in 3:9-16. Next, Krishna explains the soul's relationship with him as eternally his part and parcel, which must be learned by approaching a bona fide spiritual master. Chapter 4 ends with Krishna glorifying the transcendental knowledge and requesting Arjuna to arm himself with this knowledge, which burns all sinful reactions to ashes and fight. After Arjuna has been impressed with the importance of both work, which requires activity, and seeking knowledge, which tends to be inactive, Arjuna is perplexed. His determination is confused, and he sees fighting and knowledge as contradictory. Therefore, Arjuna opens chapter 5 by asking Krishna to definitely explain whether the renunciation of work, speculation, shankhya, jnana, and inaction in knowledge, or work and devotion is superior. Krishna answers that one who is detached from his work, is the one who is fully, truly renounced. Such a person knows that while the body acts, he, the soul, actually does nothing. Arjuna should, therefore, do his duty and steadily act for the satisfaction of Krishna. Impartially viewing the external world, he should reside in his body, aloof from bodily activities. By fixing his consciousness on the Supreme, and knowing that Krishna is the true enjoyer, the goal of sacrifice and austerity, and the Lord of all planets, he, the pure soul, will find true peace beyond this material world. In the first 5 chapters, Krishna has explained Buddhi Yoga, working with the consciousness focused on Krishna without fruit of desires. The Lord has also explained Shankhya, Karma Yoga, and Jnana Yoga as processes to obtain liberation and as stepping stones to Krishna consciousness. The end of the 5th chapter, 5:27-28, and continuing on in the 6th chapter, wherein Krishna explains practical points for a yogi, Krishna explains Jnana Yoga, concluding that jnana, or meditation upon Krishna, is the goal of meditation. Krishna begins the 6th chapter by explaining that the neophyte yogi engages in fruitive sitting postures, while the advanced yogi, the true sannyasi, works without attachment. Such a yogi liberates himself and is not degraded by his mind's activities. Carefully controlling his mind, body, and self in Krishna's service, the yogi strictly practices jnana yoga in a secluded place. Fixing his mind on the self and on Krishna, he attains transcendental happiness in the kingdom of God. Arjuna then points out that the main difficulty in practicing yoga is controlling the mind. Krishna responds by saying that one can overcome the obstinate mind through constant practice and determination. In responding to Arjuna's query about the fate of an unsuccessful yogi, Krishna answers that one unsuccessful in his practice will still take birth in a family of wise transcendentalists and automatically become attracted to yoga principles. Krishna firmly states in the last 2 verses of the chapter that the yogi is greater than the ascetic, the jnani, and the karmi. And the greatest of all yogis is he who always thinks of Krishna and with great faith worships him in loving service. Knowing Krishna's instructions at the end of chapter 6, one should initiate his practice of yoga from the point of concentrating the mind upon Krishna. Chapter 7 thus opens with Krishna explaining knowledge of himself and his opulent energies. Thus Arjuna can fully worship Krishna, as described in the end of the sixth chapter, and think of him with devotion as he fights. Krishna first explains that he is the Supreme Truth, and everything in existence is a combination of his material and spiritual energies. He is the active principle within all, and is all-pervasive through his diverse material and spiritual energies. Because the modes of nature which emanate from Krishna, and which do not affect him, control the world's activities, only those who surrender to Krishna can cross beyond these modes to know him. Four kinds of impious souls never surrender to Krishna, while four kinds of pious souls do. Krishna also covers himself from the impersonalists, who are less intelligent, and from those who surrender to demigods. But those who are truly pious, the undiluted, serve Krishna with determination and practice their devotional service on the Brahman platform, which is the goal of the impersonalists. Those souls who know Krishna as the governor of the material manifestation, the demigods and sacrifice, can know and understand Krishna, even at the time of death. Chapter 8 begins with Arjuna asking Krishna about Brahman, karma, the demigods, the material world, and knowing Krishna at the time of death. Krishna briefly answers Arjuna's first five questions, and then begins explaining in detail how to know him at the time of death. Since one attains what one remembers at the time of death, if one remembers Krishna, one goes to him. Krishna then explains how he can be constantly thought of as the transcendental person who knows everything, as the oldest, the controller, the smallest, and the maintainer. Thus, by practicing yoga and remembering him, Krishna explains, one will go to the eternal and spiritual world and never again return to this temporary, miserable material world. After describing the different yogic ways in which one may leave this world, Krishna advises Arjuna not to worry about other paths, either Vedic study, yoga, austerity, sacrifice, charity, jnana, or karma. For the results of all these will be obtained through performing devotional service. And in the end, such a yogi in devotion reaches the supreme eternal abode. After Krishna answers Arjuna's questions in Chapter 8, he continues speaking in Chapter 9, the knowledge about himself that he had begun explaining in Chapter 7. Krishna prefaces Chapter 9 by stating that the knowledge he will now reveal is most confidential, for it is about his actual position, which only the non-envious and faithful can understand. Krishna continues explaining that although independent and aloof, he pervades, creates, and annihilates the entire cosmos through his material energy. Those Mahatmas who know Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead take shelter of him and serve him as the only enjoyer and the supreme object of worship. Krishna then explains the fortunate position of such devotees. If one worships Krishna, Krishna cares for him, compensates for his deficiencies, and preserves his strengths. And all Krishna asks for is an offering of a leaf, a flower, or some water, if it is offered with devotion. Thus his devotees come to him. Even if a devotee unintentionally commits a horrendous act, he will be rectified, for Krishna promises that his devotee will never perish. In chapters 7 and 9, Krishna has explained knowledge of his energies. In chapter 10, Krishna explains his opulences more specifically and thereby reveals himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of all. Krishna also tells how his pure devotees know that he is the unborn Supreme Lord, the source of all sages, the source of the material and spiritual world, and the source of all qualities and attitudes. Thus pure and wise devotees worship Krishna, converse about him, and with thoughts dwelling in him, undiluted and free from sin, they engage in his service. Out of compassion, Krishna within their hearts destroys any remaining ignorance. After hearing of Krishna's opulences, Arjuna confirms Krishna as the Supreme Lord by quoting authorities and explains that only Krishna can thoroughly know himself. Krishna then tells of his divine manifestations within this world, as the Supersoul, the ocean, the Himalayas, which merely indicate his limitless opulences. For a single fragment of Krishna's energy pervades and supports this entire universe. Arjuna, although acknowledging that Krishna is the two-armed form that he now sees before him is supreme, still requests Krishna to reveal his all-pervading universal form that supports the universe. Thus, in chapter 11, Krishna proves himself as the Supreme Lord, and he establishes the criterion that anyone who claims to be God must also show a universal form. Krishna reveals to Arjuna his wondrous, effulgent, all-expansive form, and Arjuna sees all soldiers on both sides dying within it. Krishna explains his form as time, the destroyer of all the world, and requests that Arjuna, knowing in advance the inevitable deaths of all the warriors, become his instrument. In answer to Arjuna's fearful prayers, Krishna first shows his four-armed form before again returning to his original two-armed form. Krishna then states that his two-armed form can be seen only by pure devotees, and such pure devotees working for Krishna, free from desire for fruitive activities, making Krishna the supreme goal of their lives, certainly come to him. In chapter 12, Arjuna, after witnessing Krishna's awesome universal form, wishes to confirm his own position as a devotee. The highest worshipper of the Supreme. He thus asks whether worshipping Krishna through devotional service or worshipping the impersonal is superior. Krishna immediately responds, saying that one engaged in personal service is the topmost. One should therefore engage in Krishna's service and fix his mind solely upon Krishna. If that cannot be done, one should follow the rules and regulations of Bhakti Yoga, which purify one, so he is able to do so later. Krishna then describes other processes that eventually lead to his pure devotional service. The qualities that endear a devotee to Krishna, such as equality in both happiness and distress, independence from the ordinary course of activities, satisfaction, and the faithful following of the path of devotional service, are also mentioned as part of the processes of worshipping Krishna in devotional service. Arjuna opens chapter 13 inquiring about the field of activities and the knower of that field. Krishna answers that the conditioned soul's body and the body's interaction with the material world are his limited field of activities. By understanding the difference between the body, the soul, and the supersoul, and by following the process of knowledge, the soul can transcend dualities, realizes eternal subordination to Krishna, and obtain the supreme destination. The 13th chapter clearly explains that by humbly developing knowledge, one can become freed from material entanglements. It also explains that the living entity's entanglement within the material world is due to his association with the modes of nature, 13:20-22. In chapter 14, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains in detail the three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, as the forces that bind and control all conditioned souls within this world. A soul can, however, transcend these modes through devotional service. All other processes are contaminated by the modes. Thus, the limitations imposed by his field of activities can be overthrown, and the soul can be elevated to the Brahman platform, the constitutional position of purity and happiness, a platform from which Krishna is the basis. As one must be detached from the modes and their results in order to be attached to the service of the Lord, Krishna describes in chapter 15 the process of freeing oneself from matter's grip. He begins by comparing the material world to a gigantic upside-down banyan tree, inviting Arjuna to detach himself from it through surrender. Thus the soul can end his transmigrations and return to him in the spiritual world. Although the foolish cannot understand that the soul transmigrates from one body to another according to the mind's desires, transcendentalists see this clearly. The foolish can learn to see properly by knowing Krishna as the splendor of the sun, moon, and fire, as the one keeping the planets in orbit and making vegetables succulent, as the fire of digestion, as the Paramatma in everyone's heart, as the giver of remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness, as the goal of the Vedas and the compiler of Vedanta. Krishna reveals that knowing him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and engaging in his service is the ultimate purpose of the Vedanta and the most confidential part of the Vedas. In chapter 15, auspicious, elevating activities are described as part of the banyan tree. Chapter 16, after mentioning 26 godly qualities, Krishna explains the demoniac nature, which degrades the soul through arrogant, ignorant, and conceited pursuits of sense gratification and power. Krishna explains the demoniac mentality as follows. The demoniac think the world is unreal and produced only of sex desire. Taking shelter of lust, they think of sense gratification as the goal of life and scheme to illegally increase their wealth. While plotting to kill their enemies, they think themselves powerful and happy. And surrounded by their relatives, they use sacrifices and charity only to further increase their happiness. Perplexed by illusory anxieties, bewildered by complacency, impudency, and wealth, and envying the supersoul within their own bodies and within the bodies of others, demons blaspheme real religion. These mischievous lowest of men are repeatedly cast by Krishna into demoniac species and gradually sink to the most abominable forms of existence. Krishna ends the chapter by explaining that because lust, anger, and greed are the beginning of demoniac life, all sane men should give them up and understand their duty by faithfully following the scriptures. Krishna concludes chapter 16 declaring that the ultimate difference between the divine and demoniac is that the divine follow the scriptures while the demons do not. In the beginning of chapter 17, Arjuna inquires more about those who don't follow scripture but who worship according to their imagination. Krishna answers by describing how the combination of the modes of material nature that control a particular person will dictate his faith, worship, eating, sacrifices, charity, and austerity. The chapter ends with Krishna explaining the syllables Om Tat Sat and how these syllables indicate that any sacrifice, austerity, or charity dictated by the modes and performed without devotional service is useless in this life and the next. One should therefore directly take to Krishna's service in Krishna's consciousness. The entire Gita is concluded in 17 chapters, and in the 18th chapter, Krishna reviews the knowledge already presented. In this chapter, Krishna concludes, as he has done throughout the Bhagavad Gita, that one should practice devotional service to Krishna, devotional service, Krishna consciousness. Since Arjuna's basic reason to renounce his duty of fighting was fear of sinful reaction, Krishna explains true renunciation and how to transcend sinful reactions through 1. Becoming renounced from the fruits of activities, 2. Abiding by the order of the Supersoul, and 3. Worshipping the Lord with the fruit of one's work by acting either as a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, according to one's modes of nature. Each leads Arjuna to fight. Oh, I see, each of these three. Thus, one can achieve the self-realized position of Brahma-Bhuta, and from that position, detached from all material things, one can practice pure devotional service. Krishna can be known only through surrendering to him in devotional service. By this direct process, free from karma or jnana, Arjuna need not fear any sinful reactions. Under Krishna's protection, such a pure devotee will reach Krishna Loka. Krishna instructs Arjuna that he should surrender to the Supreme Lord within the heart, and thus attain peace in the supreme, eternal abode. The most confidential knowledge is then explained by Krishna. Become my devotee, always think of me, act for me, worship me, and offer all homage unto me. Surrender unto me alone, do not fear sinful reactions. After hearing the instructions of Sri Krishna, Arjuna is fixed and ready to fight. Sanjaya, after narrating this conversation to Dhritarashtra, ecstatically thinks of the wondrous universal form of Krishna, and predicts victory for Arjuna, the supreme archer, for he is surrendered to Krishna, the master of all mystics. So any questions on this? Still with us, still alive. So we see a basic theme throughout this is Arjuna has been bewildered by the performance of his duty, and he's quoting the Dharma Shastras that the whole society, everything will collapse because of engaging in all these activities, because he calls them sinful activities, because what will happen is, one, you're killing superiors, and at the same time is you're going to destroy the whole Vedic culture basically. And then Krishna's pointing out to him that the
vision where one is not seeing one's activities in relationship with the Lord, that is foolishness. So if one can see one's activities in relationship with the Lord, that is proper vision. So we don't see anywhere where Krishna is telling Arjuna to give up his duty. But one must do it without attachment and for Krishna. Right? And that the whole point is devotional service. So by doing in this way, that is devotional service. Otherwise, it just becomes karma. Or understanding material nature just becomes jnana. So that is not of interest. What is of interest is that one performs those activities according to Shastra. Krishna points out, the demons don't follow like to follow Shastra, the pious people do. So the difference between the demigods and the demons is that the demigods follow Shastra, the demons don't. And in the Shastra they give a lifestyle and a way of acting. And that is then performed. But it is done for Krishna. So that is the basic theme through the whole book. So at the end, when Arjuna understands this, then he is willing to fight. Otherwise, he was not willing to fight. Because he saw, if I do supposedly the duty of fighting, then all other duties of managing and maintaining a nice proper kingdom will all be lost. So he becomes all bewildered. You know, because he's seeing that the emotional platform, the emotional needs that is there in interacting with the other members of the community, then will be lost, because all those you want to interact with are going to die on the battlefield. You know, so showing the need for that kind of exchange. But Krishna's pointing out, no, we have to, the exchange is because Krishna is the center. We're not exchanging between two different persons just for sense gratification, which Arjuna had presented like this. But it is for the platform of serving Krishna. So Krishna must be the central feature of all activities. So that is basically the whole Gita, is to point this out. So is that clear? Then so chapter 1 is basically, then there's not much more to it to be explained. Some interesting points are brought out by the Acharyas. I mean, many interesting points, of course. It is the point of Dhritarashtra is worried. We see that Dhritarashtra is already cut the Pandavas out of the family lineage by saying the Kurus and the Pandavas. What are they doing? The Pandavas, just their Kuru is just their sons of Pandu. Kuru is the whole dynasty, right? But Pandavas just mean within that dynasty they are the sons of Pandu. But he separates them. So he's making this point. But he's a little worried because he knows the Supreme Lord's on their side, and they're pious, and the activity, the war is going to happen in a religious place. So he's afraid that the influence of this religious place is going to have some bad effect for his sons. So he opens the inquiry this way. Then Duryodhana, he starts to perform his politics. He wants everything to go very nicely. So he's going to Drona. See, now he has Bhishma and he has Drona, and both are great fighters. But he has the dilemma, whichever one he goes to first, the other one might feel bad, why you didn't consider me the greater. So after considering it, then he knows if he approaches it from the angle of Duryodhana as the teacher, the Brahmin, then Bhishma as a Kshatriya will accept that. He will have no problems with that. So then he starts with that. And then he points out, then we have Bhishma and all these others. And then, besides that, he doesn't want everybody else to feel that they're any less. So then he starts mentioning all the other persons. Dhrishtaketu. No, this is after. Karna, Kripa, Ashwatthama, Vikarna, and the son of Somadatta. So Vikarna is one of his brothers. Out of the 100 brothers, Vikarna was the only one that complained, why you're doing this to Draupadi? So he didn't want him to defect to the other side. So he also mentioned him, though he's not a great fighter like all these others. But he mentioned like this. Then he wants Bhishma to fight very hard. So he uses a double meaning in the word immeasurable, aparyaptam. So he says our power is immeasurable, you know, protected by Bhishma. And the Pandavas is small, protected by Bhima. So he wants to encourage Bhishma to fight and everything. At the same time, he's encouraging Dronacharya, because another meaning of aparyaptam is not so much. Means insufficient, because he feels that Bhishma, because of his, he has affection for the Pandavas, and not so much. Dutifully, he serves the Dhritarashtra, but affectionately, he deals with the Pandavas. So he feels that's a weakness. So also, this aparyaptam means that he wants Drona and others to understand that Bhishma is a little weak because of this. So they're also going to have to come in and support. He says in the one way, he's an old man and you all take care and all that. He's strong like this, same time you all there, you have to support. Same time Drona, you have to kind of take care because this man is not fully on our side. So like this he deals. And so after saying all these nice things about Bhishma, Bhishma doesn't answer, he just blows his conch shell. And because the conch shell then represents Vishnu, so he's basically pointing out that, don't worry, Vishnu's going to win, like that. So he just, as he's saying all of his nice political things, he just kind of like cuts him off with the conch shell. So it's taken that Bhishma now is ready to fight, and he blows his conch shell. But basically he's, you know, heard enough of this kind of stuff, political jargon, and now it's just time to, okay, like that. You know, it's in the Lord's hands. It means the conscious Vishnu. Vishnu is the supreme controller. It's up to him. How it's going to go, it's up to him. You may say this one, that one, and so many things, but it's going to go how Krishna wants. Then the Pandavas and all that, they play all their conch shells and drums and bugles, and they make big sound. It's transcendental sound. While Duryodhana and all them, it's material. Great material sound, but still material. Then Arjuna, you know, in the mood of, okay, let's see, you know, the Kshatriya, who's here? We want to see who's here to fight. Tells Arjuna, Krishna, you take my chariot out into the middle of the battlefield. Like that. Another aspect, though, is Prabhupada brings out a point in this, is that even though Krishna is the Supreme Lord, because of his affection for his devotees, therefore he became the chariot driver. This is very important that we see the point, how this exchange between the Lord and his devotees is going on. So this is not just a purely an academic or intellectual exchange here, but this is actually the affection of the Lord for his devotees. So that Prabhupada brings out at this point. Then he wants to see who has come to fight. Then, now Arjuna then, it says, then Krishna drew up the fine chariot in the midst of both the armies. In the presence of Bhishma, Drona, and all the other chieftains of the world, the Lord said, just behold, Partha, all the crews assembled here. So then it's kind of like Krishna on purpose drove right up in front of Bhishma and Drona and other senior members and others of the family. Just so Krishna and Arjuna then would have the opportunity to see, you know, this is all family we're fighting. And this would, one, give an opening for the Bhagavad Gita being spoken, because then Arjuna would become bewildered by all this. And then he also says, but Krishna can tell that just because he wants to go see means he's already becoming a little doubtful. Otherwise, why would he want to see? He knows who's there. He's been, this war has been in the making for, you know, so many years. I mean, 14 years they were waiting for it. Arjuna went to the heavenly planets. Since they had 14 years, they figured, why not? Why doesn't he go to the heavenly planets and get a few more weapons? So the whole idea was preparing for this war. Now suddenly he says, take my chariot out into the middle. So he says it as, you know, a Kshatriya spirit, but actually it's, you know, he's getting a little worried, you know, who's here? It's kind of like everybody's rolled up, it's everybody I know. Like that. So that's being pointed out, that this is... And when he got out there, he saw everybody was relatives. Bhurishrava were his father's contemporaries, grandfathers like Bhishma, Somadana, Datta, teachers, Drona and Kripa, maternal uncles, Salya and Shakuni, brothers like Duryodhan, sons like Lakshmana, friends like Ashwatthama, well-wishers, Pritavarma. So you could see everybody was just there. So then he became overwhelmed, and there's, Bhurijan Prabhu points out, classifies that there's five different categories of what his disturbance was. One is compassion. He points out Arjuna has deep compassion for those he is about to kill. He doesn't want to kill his loved ones. So the compassion is there. Then enjoyment, too. This is less noble reason. Arjuna knows it will be impossible for him to enjoy the kingdom if he wins at the cost of the lives of his family members. Then three, destruction of family. With the death of so many great Kshatriyas, irreligion will flourish. Unprotected women will be corrupted by unscrupulous men. Therefore, society will be overrun by unwanted progeny. The traditional Vedic rituals will no longer be performed because no one will be qualified to perform them. And thus, hell will await both the family and the destroyer of the family. Then, four, is fear of sinful reactions. Arjuna thinks that the enjoyment of royal happiness is not worth the suffering he will have to undergo as a sinful reaction for destroying the family and killing his superiors. And five is indecision. Arjuna is not convinced that conquering his enemies is better than being conquered by them. The kingdom is flourishing under Duryodhana's rule, so why should the Pandavas fight only to take over the kingdom for themselves? He wonders whether millions of people should die just to enthrone him and his family. Arjuna is soft-hearted, compassionate, and logical. He knows Shastra and is cultured and intelligent. Because of these qualities, his heart breaks when he sees his friends and relatives ready to fight. Okay. So, Prabhupada points out that this compassion is because of this soft-heartedness of being a devotee. Okay, then some words in this last bit, that's the words nimittani and viparitani. Srila Prabhupada points out causes and just the opposite. Arjuna foresees that the very events he fears will necessarily occur, and he thinks this battle will cause just the opposite of his desires. So he has desires. We're going to go out there, we're going to win, and then we're going to be on the top. All these things are going to happen, right? They've been planning for so many years. But now he's seeing, well, actually, it's not going to happen like that. We're going to go out here, we're going to win the war, but then all the people that we were, you know, all they wanted to do was remove the Duryodhanadis, you know? At least those who don't want to cooperate. They don't really have a problem with anybody else. You know, maybe Shakuni, like that, or Karna. But otherwise, everybody else in the family is not a problem. So the idea is that when they're in the forest, we're going to get rid of Duryodhana. And then we're going to carry on very nicely. But now he understands that's not what's going to happen. We're going to have this war, we're going to wipe out everybody, and then all the people we thought we'd be sitting around and, you know, enjoying the kingdom with, aren't going to be present. There's going to be no one there. So then he sees that, well, maybe their plans aren't going to get the fruit he desires. So the battle won't give that fruit.
So,
yeah.
Prabhupada points out here, purport, Arjuna envisioned only painful reverses in the battlefield. He would not be happy even by gaining victory over the foe. When a man sees only frustration in his expectations, he thinks, why am I here? Everyone is interested in himself and his own welfare. No one is interested in the Supreme Self. Arjuna is showing ignorance of his real self-interest by Krishna's will. One's real self-interest lies in Vishnu or Krishna. The conditioned soul forgets this and therefore suffers material pains. Arjuna thought that his victory in the battle would only be a cause of lamentation for him. Then he calls Krishna various names. He calls him here Janardana because he's the maintainer of all living entities. So he wants to know how it is you want to kill everybody if you're the maintainer. The same way Jana means person and Ardana means killer. So then Baladev points out that, well, if you want to kill everybody, then why don't you do it yourself? You know, you're the one who came to remove the burden of the earth, so you're the Jana Ardana, you're the killer of everybody, so why do I have to get involved? And because if Krishna does it, then there won't be any sinful reactions. So if Arjuna does it, sinful reactions will be there. So he's suggesting this would be a better solution here. Then he calls Krishna Madhava, the husband of the goddess of fortune. So he's thinking, Baladev points out that Madhava, why are you, the husband of the goddess of fortune, engaging me in this unfortunate battle? So this battle is not going to give a good result, but you are Madhava, the husband of the goddess of fortune, means all wonderful things. So it seems to be that this dichotomy is kind of there. And then he mentions Sinuloba Kavas, if we slay aggressors. Prabhupada points out that the six aggressors, one who gives poison, an arsonist, one who attacks with deadly weapons, a thief, one who occupies another land, and one who kidnaps another's wife, can be killed. And the Duryodhana Adis, they did all these. So therefore, he can kill. But then Arjuna is taking to Dharma Shastra, saying Dharma Shastra is higher than the Artha Shastra. So he quotes from that then in this. So he mentions about, now he comes to the point where he mentions about the family tradition will be destroyed, irreligion is prominent in the family, increase of unwanted population, you know, and then, you know, so all these sins will come. And then Prabhupada points out in the purport from the Bhagavatam 11.5.41, this Devarshi Bhutapta Nirnam Pitri Nam. Anyone who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda, the giver of liberation, giving up all kinds of obligation and has taken to the path in all seriousness, owes neither duties nor obligations to the demigods, sages, general living entities, family members, mankind, or forefathers. So when one does for Krishna, then one is under Krishna's protection. One doesn't have all these duties. He's saying all these duties we have. And then Prabhupada points out, if you surrender to Krishna, you don't have it. And then he goes on to say how everything will be destroyed in the family. And he says then, because if we're going to do all these things, it's very sinful, better I just give up all this and just go to the forest and beg. You know, we're going to lose out on Dharma anyway, so I might as well go to the forest. You know? But the problem comes is that... Yeah. Oh, excuse me. Here he doesn't say that he will do that. Here his point is that, alas, how strange it is we are preparing to commit greatly sinful acts, driven by the desire to enjoy rural happiness. We are intent on killing our own kinsmen. Better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, weapons in hand, were to kill me unarmed and unresisting on the battlefield. So here, then, as pointed out, is that he's not saying he'll run away. I'll just stand there and let them kill me. Because, anyway, if he doesn't fight, he doesn't have his occupation. What's his occupation? Is the Kshatriya supposed to fight and do all these activities? So better let them just kill me, because I can't go out begging, right? Kshatriyas don't beg. And then how do you say it? Bhurijan gives the example how Bhima, he met how do you say it?
He went to meet Hanuman. I mean, when they went to going to the Himalayas, when Arjuna had left, gone to the heavenly planets, then while they were wandering around, then this lotus flower, a thousand-petaled lotus flower, very wonderful fragrance, came floating down the river, and Draupadi saw this, and you know, Bhima fished it out for her. She thought, this is very nice, we should get some more. We can offer them to Yudhishthira and take some back to our ashram. So Bhima thinks, I'll go and get them. So he continues and he goes up into the, because now they're at the limit of how far humans go. Beyond that, only the devas and the, you know, anyone above the human platform, I mean the earthly platform, can move. So he goes there. And he's going through the forest and yelling, screaming, any tree in the way pushes it over, and roaring, and all the different animals of the forest are running away in fear, and all this. And he's going like this, you know, just having a good time, till he comes across this huge monkey across the path, laying down on the path. So then, you know, out of etiquette, he doesn't step over the monkey, but he tells them, you know, why don't you move? And the monkey says, what's going on? Why are you yelling and screaming so much? He says, I got things to do. Don't you worry about it. Now, can you kindly move? And he says, I can't. Why don't you just move me out of the way? So then he thinks, well, I'm not going to bother with this guy. So I'll just go around him. And maybe his tail's in the way. So he just went over and thought, well, I'll just move his tail and just go. Because he's old anyway, so he's not going to... He can't pick up the tail. So then after this, he understands it can't be an ordinary monkey. Then he finds out it's Hanuman. And then they're both very, very happy, because they're both sons of Vayu. So they've met each other after a long time, and they're discussing and all that. And then Bhima, you know, wanted to see the form of that Hanuman took when he flew to Lanka. So Hanuman takes this huge form like that, you know, and so they're very happy and sitting there. And then Hanuman knows, you know, why they're there and the whole thing going on, and says, you know, in the war, then I will come on Arjuna's chariot, and whenever Bhima is out on the battlefield, and he is, you know, getting out his club, having a good time, and he's roaring and doing things, Hanuman will also roar. So together, the two of them roaring, then that will, you know, strike fear into the hearts of the opposing army. Like this. So then after all these, you know, niceties and meeting, then Bhima continues. And then he gets to the lake where the lotuses are. So immediately just goes in and starts picking flowers. And then the yakshas and rakshasas that are there to protect the place, they all come. And so this is Kuvera's lake. And you want to pick lotus flowers here, then you go ask Kuvera. If he says, fine, we have no problem. But if you don't ask him, then we have a problem. Then you'll have to fight with us. So now, the Kshatriyas, they work on a slightly different, the culture is a little different. It's not that they don't ask. It means because they were servants, they're not Kshatriyas, then they thought Bhima should deal in the same way as them. Whatever they do, they ask the superior, and they do that. So they expected Bhima will also do the same. But being a Kshatriya, they should have asked him, why you have come here? And then he would have said, we have come, who are you? And he would have said his lineage, and they would have understood, here is a great king. They would have said, please, you be our guest, you just sit down and either take him to Kuvera or keep him there. They would go and inform Kuvera. There would be some nice arrangement. They would meet nicely. And then, you know, they would understand they want some flowers. Kuvera would give these flowers. And, you know, Bhima would go after some nice reception and some, you know, nice Kshatriya interface like this. And then they would have left. But they didn't. They just went up to him and just said, you touch these flowers, we fight. So then for Kshatriya, if this is said, we fight. It's the, I don't not fight and go ask somebody. If it comes between, you've said we either fight or I ask somebody, we fight. If you come to me like a gentleman and say, you know, how can we help you, and then proper reception is there for a king, then the king is peaceful. But if you come right up to him and say, let's fight, that's okay, let's fight. No problem. So then immediately he starts fighting and all this. He doesn't beg. And then after it becomes a big mess, then Kuvera hears about it. because the Rakshasas and that didn't go back to him, and especially most of them after the fight didn't go back. So a few that escaped with their lives went back, and then what they should have done, then Kuvera came out, received him, and he was a guest and all that, and then afterwards then said, you take these flowers, and then, you know, like that. I think he even had them sent back. I think Kuvera even flew him back on some of his Rakshasas just to speed things up, because he was sorry that his servants had dealt so badly. They had not received him properly. So the point is that Kshatriyas don't beg when it comes down to a fight like that. So here then Arjuna is just saying, well, better they kill me unarmed, because I can't fight, but I can't just go out begging. And then the chapter ends that Arjuna then casts aside his bows and arrows and sits down. So then a point is being made here, which is very interesting. It's because Arjuna has made this vow that anyone who tells him to put down his bows and arrows, he'll kill him. So now he himself is putting it down. So it's just a very strange contradiction, because later in the battle, then there was that one time Yudhishthir and Karna got into a fight, and Karna then defeated Yudhishthir, filled him with arrows, you know, very badly attacked him. But Karna just said, it was so easy, you know, it's like not even worth it to kill you. You know, I mean, as if there was a good fight, then it's worth killing. You go to the heavenly planets. But, you know, it's just such a pushover, I'm not even going to bother. So, you know, you can leave now. So Yudhishthir went back to the camp, and then Arjuna heard about it. So Arjuna immediately left and went to the camp. So now, when he came in, then Yudhishthir thought, you know, okay, Arjuna's come to say that I heard about your fight with Karna. I went there, I defeated Karna, and the prestige of our dynasty is then maintained. So Yudhishthir was very happy to see him. You know, because Arjuna went to the heavenly planets to get all these divine weapons just to kill Karna and to all these people. So, you know, that's what he's expecting. Then he finds out that Arjuna has just come to see him. He didn't fight first and then come to say, yes, we've avenged prestige of the family. He just came because out of brotherly affection. So then Yudhishthir says, you know, this is not Kshatriya. You know, I mean, what is this? You should just put down your bow and just, you know, go do something else, you know? So then immediately Arjuna's, someone told me to put down my bow, you know? So he pulls out his sword, ready to kill Yudhishthir. And Krishna is there, so he's chuckling at this whole thing. So he says, you know, and Arjuna doesn't know what to do, because he's made a vow, and Kshatriyas have to keep their word, that he'll kill whoever it is. But it's Yudhishthir, it's his brother. So then Krishna suggests that also for a Kshatriya, insult is, you know, also worse than death. So then he starts to say, so then Arjuna puts his sword away and then just says, you talk about Kshatriyas, you know, where was the Kshatriya spirit when, you know, Draupadi was being disrobed there? I would have gone and killed the whole assembly hall, but you wouldn't allow me, you know, you and your dharma. You know, what kind of Kshatriya is this? So after saying a few choice words like that, yeah, and he said, so he mentioned, you're not a king, you know. And in this way, then afterwards, then he approached Yudhishthir and, you know, touched his feet, offered his obeisances, and then it was all worked out. So it's very, very significant that here that he said he'll kill anybody who tells him to put down his bow, but here he himself is putting it down. So that ends the first chapter and the, you know, basic kind of like various points that the acharyas make on this. So if there's any questions on that, we'll end here. Yes.
Arjuna is obviously a devotee. The whole interface is spoken just to convince Arjuna to become a devotee. And he's obviously a devotee because he asked Krishna to drive his chariot. So he's connected with Krishna. It appears that he didn't even understand his intimacy, he didn't realize he was a stupid person to God, otherwise he wouldn't accept and simultaneously in the same words like Janardana, you can kill everyone if you like to go to Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Oh, I see. Is because in the question is that Arjuna seems to have forgotten that Krishna is, or doesn't consider that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And, you know, therefore he doesn't mind him driving his chariot and these things. At the same time, as here he's using words like Janardana and Madhusudana and all these different words, which show that he is the Supreme Lord. So why this contradiction? Because in the friendship, he knows he's the Supreme Lord. But because his rasa is that of friendship, equality, then they kind of joke like that. Because their relationship is, Kunti is Vasudev's sister. So I think Vasudev is in, what, the Vrishni dynasty, Vrishni or Bhoja, like this. So they're a sub-group of the Kuru dynasty. They're connected to the Kuru dynasty. In other words, they're kings that are always under the Sun dynasty. But they're the Moon dynasty. But Arjuna, his father is Pandu, he's directly in that Sun line. They're not on the side. So technically amongst the Kshatriya circles, Arjuna is by, you know, family lineage and the prestige that's connected with that is in a higher position than Krishna. So sometimes just for joking, then he'll say those things, kind of things like that. They'll sit on the bed together, and when it comes to something, then he'll make that comment to, you know, kind of show that, well, actually, when it comes down to it, we're actually the superior family, and you're coming from the, you know, you're coming from our vassals. It means we're the emperors, and you're the local kings. So, you know, like that. You know, so. But he does know he's the Supreme Lord, but it's just in that friendship that is lost. Because there's still, within Dwarka, Ayodhya, like this, where you have the manifestation of Mahanarayan. But you have all the five rasas manifest. So Yoga Maya must be there to some degree, but still, it's still based on the rules and regulations, the vidhi. Is very prominent. That's why this Gita would be spoken to Arjuna and not to, you know, Madhu Mangal or someone. Because in Vrindavan, the vidhi is not so strong. So for us, as practitioners of bhakti, the vaidhi sadhana, or sadhana bhakti is very important. Therefore, these process of nishkam karma and these activities to elevate ourselves within the realm of sadhana bhakti is important. So Arjuna is the proper one to tell, not the residents of Vrindavan. So in Vrindavan, they've totally forgot. Even if someone mentioned it, it doesn't matter at all. You see, Arjuna, both aspects are there. He's friend, but if too strong of the element is there, he does click into that. But otherwise, it's there. They know he's God, and they can always depend. So they know the glories. Even the gopis in Vrindavan, they know. They're complaining to Krishna, we know you, you're not very kind, you know, you don't deal properly with the ladies, you know, and they say, look what you did to Suparnika, you know, like that, you cut off her ears and nose, that wasn't a nice thing to do, so we know how you behave. So they know, here's Krishna who has come as Lord Ramachandra, has performed these pastimes, and then, you know, had Suparnika's nose cut off, but they're only using that as a ploy in their pastime. It's not an awe and reverence dealing. It's that they're just bothering Krishna, you know? As, you know, girls like to bother boys or boys like to bother girls. They're just using it as a medium through which they can bother him. So that aspect, with a little bit more of the rules and regulations, will be what Arjuna is there. So they know. But it, for the pastime, it doesn't become much important. You know? And because Krishna is so involved in their pastime and dealing also as a king and all that and following the duties and all, so then they're inspired to do their duties and like that. You know, it's also like, a, how is it? That whole thing of Duryodhana getting Shalya. Shalya was one of the great warriors, and he's one of the best charioteers. You know, probably other than Krishna and Daruka, there's no one better than him. So now you have Karna. Who's going to drive his chariot? Unless he has someone good to drive his chariot, who's going to fight with Arjuna? Right? Because he has to go out as a king on a chariot, Maharathi. If he goes out on foot, they'll laugh at him. So therefore, Duryodhana went to all the trouble to specifically go and personally as Shalya. You know the story? Shalya was coming from his kingdom, and way on the outskirts of the Kuru territory, then he comes and he finds, you know, this huge, like, guest facility set up. These, from what I understand, that this modern, this what we see nowadays, the modern system in India, the pandals, you know, like marriage pandals and big, that was originally an art that was used by the kings. Like when they travel with their armies, when they camp, they don't just camp, you know, under a cactus somewhere or something like that, you know, sleep on top of their saddle of their horse, or like, no. They live in their palaces. They do all the things they do. Because they travel with an army and all the servants and everything. So a party goes ahead and builds a like a pandal city. And they live in that. You know? Like that. So that came. So one of these was there. And then, you know, he's taking care of them. There's some guy there with a big turban on and all that and ordering people around and, you know, and he gets taken care of, and slowly after a while then he sees that, you know, this person is taken care of so nicely and all that, and he said, and then Sahya just said, he's so pleased because he figures that Yudhishthira has done this. No one else would do this. You know, because I think his uncle is something, some relative like this. And then he tells them that whoever has done this, you know, arranged all this, you know, I give my full, you know, blessings to them, whatever they like, you know, I would fully support them. And then at that time, you know, Duryodhana is the, you know, the head steward who is taking care of anything, you know, then I think takes off his turban and all that, and then reveals that he's Duryodhana, and he's arranged all this. So then, because of his word, then Salya gets stuck like that, but he came specifically to fight for Krishna. But Duryodhana wanted him because he could drive the chariot. So he agreed to drive the chariot, but only if because he knows chariots, no one else knows. Even though, you know, Karna is the son of a charioteer, he doesn't know chariots like him. So he shouldn't do any backseat driving, you know? It's like, I go where I know is the best place to go, and if he tells me what to do, that's it. Like that. And we also see that it's interesting that even, what's his name? Karna has a attitude problem because he has a Bhishma doesn't like him at all. Bhishma's mind, here's the son of a charioteer. He's just got something against Arjuna. And, you know, it's just not proper. The culture is not proper. And Duryodhana is supporting him due to his own materialistic mood. You know, Karna has a bad mood. We don't want to get involved in all this. So Karna said, I will not fight until Bhishma is dead. Right? So Duryodhana has to put up with all this kind of stuff and pull all the strings. And then Salya, you know, because of who Karna is and his attitude says, you know, if he tells me anything to do, you know, that's it. You know, that's how he gets stuck in the mud. Or yeah, because he's going along and then Karna starts telling him stuff to do, and then he just says, I told you, don't tell me what to do. But Karna is like, you're the charioteer, I tell you what to do. He says, fine, you drive it. So Karna is trying to drive it with one hand and shoot arrows with another, and he gets stuck in the mud. And then that's the end of Karna. See, backseat driving can be dangerous. Bad for your health. How do we get onto that? I don't remember how we got there. Oh well. Was your question answered? Oh yeah. So it's here. Krishna is doing, but he's protecting Arjuna. Krishna's driving the chariot, but you know, it's like Arjuna tells him this, that. It's just a whole reciprocation, because we see Arjuna tells Krishna, "You drive my chariot out into the middle." Krishna says, "Fine. Huh? You want to see who all your friends are? Yeah, let's go." And then he goes out and drives right in front of Bhishma and Drona. You know, here are your teachers. You know? Anyone else you want to see? You know, kind of like. So he's kind of like they're having, you know, the rasas going on. That's where we'll see tomorrow that when Arjuna surrenders to Krishna as the disciple, Krishna doesn't take it seriously at first. Like that. Because they're always friends. They're always laughing and joking with each other. So, you know, sometimes friends, you know, you do something and get the other one upset or this or that, and then you go, "Oh, yeah, sorry, this, that, nah, don't give me that." And, you know, it's like this. It goes on. So we'll see that tomorrow. Anything else? So, thank you. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.